Welcome to Season 6 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we're continuing our journey of broadening our knowledge in the field of combat sports science by speaking to experts in the fields of nutrition science, psychology, strength and conditioning, and much more to help you become the best practitioner you can be. Today, our guest on the podcast is Dean Amasinghe. Dean is a returning guest to the podcast and is the current technical director of the UFC Performance Institute. In this episode, we'll be breaking down the new UFC PI journal named A Cross-Sectional Performance Analysis and Projection of the UFC Athlete, Volume 2. We'll be breaking down Dean's contributions to the journal, more specifically the programming and training of the MMA athlete during the different stages of preparation and camp. There's a lot to cover, so let's get to it. There we go. And green light means we are live. And for the first time ever, I don't know if Zoom has done an update on their app. It just told me that recording is in progress. So I know we are live, ready to go. So joining me for a second time, all the way from Shanghai, China, Mr. Dean Amasinghe. Amasinghe or Amasinghe? Am I saying that right, Dean?
Amasinghe, yeah.
Amasinghe, director. No longer the director. You have a new role now, the technical director of the UFC Performance Institute, Shanghai. Dean, tell us a little bit about that and how that new role came on.
Yeah, so we had a restructuring of some of the staff, some things that didn't quite work out, and we went a different direction. And so I was originally director of MMA and sort of coming overseeing that side of things, and then now since that restructuring I'm overseeing the performance side of stuff as well, but ultimately it's a it was an interdisciplinary team, and we have incredible managers in each department. Obviously I know Reed really well, and for the most part those guys are completely running those departments, and is really being overseen by Duncan anyway, who's VP of performance across both sites. But just like having a point man and making sure that everything's aligned with what I want on the MMA side and how the performance services are supporting that, and trying to streamline how we work together as a team. And I think we've got a fantastic team that we're actually adding to right now, and it's we're in a really good spot right now. So I'm excited about what we've got ahead of us.
Yeah, last time we spoke, I think you were in Canada. I think you were telling me that you just got out before COVID hit. I think you and your daughter and your partner went over to Canada. I was talking to you from there. What's been happening since then? That was maybe not quite a year, but close to a year ago. How's everything been? You survived COVID? What's been happening?
Yeah, that was a crazy time. We kind of like followed COVID around the world. So we left China when it was all going off, and no one knew that it was going to be to the level that it ended up being, and then I was in Thailand for a while, went to Vegas at the head office for a while, and then Vegas went into lockdown, and I went to Canada because my wife's Canadian, and we were there for a couple of months. Then I went to England to see my family because things were opening up back in England, and then during that time we weren't able to come back to Shanghai, and it was it was getting a bit sketchy at that point of like not knowing when we were able to continue the work. And one of the main reasons I'm coming on today is to talk about the journal. And although that was a challenging time when we were away, looking back on it, I think the amount of work that went into that journal, and you can see how in depth it is, I don't think we would have been able to do that if we were in both PIs working the way that we normally do, like considering what my schedule is like now. And it actually really gave us the time to work together. It was a really good process of, as you can see from all the different sections of it's Shanghai and Vegas working together on almost every collaborative piece or section, so that was really good for the bonding of the team across Shanghai and Vegas, because generally we don't get to work together that much realistically, just because of time differences, and there's different things going on and different sort of paradigms in compared to Las Vegas and Shanghai with our academy model and the UFC centered model in Vegas, so that was really good for that and establishing those bonds, but also just department to department and interdisciplinary, like working together really well. So it was fortuitous, like a situation, considering how difficult it was with COVID. And then China did eventually open up and we were able to come back. I got back to the end of end of September, beginning of October, but it has been challenging because the visa that we got didn't allow our spouses to come. So I'm here on my own at the moment, and I've been here since that time without my family, which is the same for all the expat staff that have returned. So that has made it really difficult. But, you know, look, I've got lots to be grateful for. I'm doing a job I love. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are in much worse situations than myself right now. And, you know, it's tough, but it's manageable for the moment. And, you know, I know a lot of people in sport and sport performance that have lost their job during this time. So, you know, I can't complain. The USBC have been so supportive to all of us. And it just is what it is right now. It's just the current world climate, and you've got to sort of adapt and you know, realize that we're still in a fortunate position. So yeah, apart from that, since we've got back, it's been great. And, you know, we're adding to the team. Like I said, we've got, you know, new strengthening and conditioning coach coming on board after the Olympics, because he's currently working with the COC in the Olympics. We've got a new physio come on board, new technical coaches coming on as well, and other coordinators as well. So the team is expanding considerably to accommodate some of the larger size of the academy and the capacity that's on us with our relationship with the COC and servicing the COC agreement, but then also our academy and all the services that we offer right now. So it's an exciting time for us as a PI in Shanghai. And it's been a good few months since we've been back here and things operating.
Busy. And like you said, that's what I got you guys on to talk about, a cross-sectional performance analysis and projection of the UFC athlete volume 2. Now, this is probably the most comprehensive piece of work that exists in the field of mixed martial arts, especially in the side of science, which both you and I reside in. What I want to get you on for, Dean, because you contribute so much to this, like you said, and going through all that COVID period, it's crazy that you guys are able to get together and still put out such a huge volume of this. There's a lot to get through, so let's get straight to it. It's broken up into quite a few parts. What I think we'll do is we'll just go through each part. I want to get the major learnings from each section, because we could break down each miniature section within, but if anyone's at home and they're listening, I highly encourage, go to the UFC website. You can download this for free, read through it. But Dean, section one, or part one, strategy and goals, can you kind of break through what's the overarching theme when it comes to this, the strategies and goals?
Yeah, so I mean, with the first section being around competition analysis and what's actually going on in fights, in terms of the way that fights finish, the different fight durations for different weight categories and et cetera, and there's as a coach, there are takeaways that you can take from a technical perspective, but also from a performance perspective in terms of the physical requirements for the sport. So there's aspects about that section that's you know, really quite valuable and interesting, and seeing the differences between over time how things have changed and as the sport's developed and as, you know, greater athletes have got involved, or the training methodologies that have been introduced for MMA and largely, I think, you know, the PI and from when we started, the impact of the information that's been shared around that, I think there's been a real change in the sport, because we have interactions with somewhat 75, don't exactly quote me on it, but I think it's around 75% of the roster have engaged with the PI in some way or form, which is pretty incredible considering where, you know, we started from. And that's largely to do with you know, the direction of Duncan and the team out there in Vegas, and how that's all, how good a relationship they have, not only with the athletes, but the coaches that supply the athletes, obviously, to the UFC. But one of the big things that Duncan has as a philosophy is that if you're not assessing, you're guessing. So from my perspective, you know, on the technical analysis particularly, let me have a look for it. It's going to take me ever for it to scroll to. I don't really want to scroll to it all the way. I'll be here all day. But basically, when we're looking at the technical analysis and breaking down the what I've put into or we put into the 11 technical categories of mixed martial arts, and how some of them are taken from the diagram I put together of the foundational martial arts, and how they go into like certain aspects that you could just take from those foundational martial arts, like kickboxing and whatnot, and then the level of techniques that are only are unique to MMA, that don't come from the traditional martial arts. And as the sport has developed, it's more about it's as much about the integration of those technical categories and realizing what is unique to MMA, what works for MMA, and what doesn't. And you're seeing, I feel like we're going into that this generation now of fighters that are coming through that have come to the sport of MMA as MMA. You're still always going to get people with like a particular background, maybe from wrestling, just because of how extensive the collegiate system is in America. But for the most part, I think you're going to see more and more people that maybe at high school and whatnot, they do wrestling, but they come to MMA as a sport and have an understanding of as a sport, because gyms are true MMA gyms rather than, you know, when I was fighting, it was you know, I went jiu-jitsu to train here, I went wrestling to train there, and we thought it was the sport was compartmentalized. So I think an important part of development as a as an athlete and the way you approach it for a coach is looking at where those athletes' skill set lies across that those technical categories and looking at their strengths and weaknesses, and then having an approach, whether they're in off camp or fight camp, about what you focus on in those times. So going back to that statement of if you're not assessing, you're guessing, like what are you, how are you deciding what you're working on to develop them as an athlete if you're not assessing them? And are you just doing general training, and how is it individualized to that athlete for developing what they need to develop if you haven't initially assessed where they are, where their strengths and weaknesses? And it comes to it later in terms of the different coaching philosophies around off camp is potentially more of like a weakness focus. And when I say weakness, it's a broad term in terms of things that have a bigger area for progression. And then in fight camp, more focus on strengths and what they want to do. And that plays into the confidence of the athlete of like working on what they want to be doing rather than thinking about what maybe your opponent is doing. And in that off camp environment where maybe it's not quite as high intensity and there isn't the pressure of a date that a fight that you're working towards, it creates a learning environment that is more conducive to a training environment that's more conducive to learning, where the pressure isn't on and you can be a bit more fun, and those types of training situations with not as high intensity sparring or live situations where you can test things out and the consequences of those mistakes, if you don't do them quite right, aren't as severe. Whereas when you go into fight camp, you want to be, you know, ramping up that sparring and doing more what, you know, what your best attributes are, so that and then if you always train like that, you're going to keep people in a box of only wanting to do the things they're good at, because the consequences are high of having high intensity, if that makes sense. So that's kind of a big part of the where you start with the technical assessments of like having an approach for the different phases of camp, and how as a coach how you go through the process of choosing what you're going to work on with a particular athlete.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, there's so many different facets and so many variables when you're assessing these guys. And this is something that I really liked about this, and something you spoke about in a later section is the periodization of the training and then the training load management in MMA. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, largely here in one of the things that's unique about here in Shanghai is that because the academy athletes are here and we're in control of all of their training, because they do it all here under one roof, it's easy to like reliably monitor their training load. Whereas in Vegas, where for starters, some of the athletes are quite transient and they come in for a period of time and they may just use it in Vegas, they're not based in Vegas, and then they go away, or even the ones that they're working sometimes with multiple coaches, it makes it difficult to monitor their training load like accurately. Whereas here, we're using our SRP scale that we monitor after each training load. After each training session, and then obviously because I plan out each session considerably far in advance, timing wise, we also know how long it is. So then we can work out the training load, and then hopefully I have a coach's planned RPE of what I want those sessions, and then when we can plan moving forward how I want to do the daily undulation of periodization and then also the weekly across the mesocycle, but then you can also retrospectively look back and see if there's any anomalies to what the athletes are responding to in terms of the training load, and then what I have planned for them, and are they responding how we want them to, and is it in line with is a high day actually a high day, or is it, you know, using that to as a measure, because often coach's eye is a great thing for, you know, looking at an athlete if they're overtraining and whatnot. But when, you know, we have 30, sometimes 40 guys, including the UFC guys, that are using the facility. So to me, to have a connection with 40 guys to read them in the way that, you know, when you're working with two or three guys, as soon as they come onto the mat, you know, you kind of know whether they're like, where they're at, with their high energy, or where they're sitting down when you get there, etc. But it just gives us objective measures somewhat objective, obviously, because it's a subjective rating of perceived exertion, but it's giving us the tools to make informed decisions about what their training load is like. So that's really useful for me in terms of where, when I have a high week and I want to be, you know, taking them up that ladder of increasing their training load, and is it actually doing what I'm planning for them to be doing? Because I think historically, it's kind of been an attitude of like train hard until someone like feels that they can't do it anymore, and then you give them a break for a few days, and then it's like train hard again, and then maybe isn't the it's more of a, we try to have a philosophy is like we schedule breaks in there before they're forced to take breaks, so that on the next time they can actually take it to that higher level of intensity, rather than, you know, being just at one level, having the peaks and troughs to take them to new highs. So that's the kind of the overall arching sort of philosophy of that periodization, and also how the taper is incredibly important as well. So, you know, one of the other things that we try to communicate is that often as well, people like to train quite close up to the fight, and then not realizing that the body, when you give the body a stimulus here, it takes, you know, a certain amount of time for the body to adapt to that stimulus. So if you're training hard during fight week, you're not seeing the benefits of that hard training until after the fight. So you want to time it so that the hardest training is maybe two weeks out, and then you'll effectively reap the rewards on fight day, and you're feeling more energized, and you're actually peaking, rather than sometimes you could potentially peak after the fight, which is not what you're hoping to do, and it's hard to get around that that mentality of sometimes less is more, particularly during that taper. But when a fighter wants to, they think, oh, am I training hard enough? It takes a lot of confidence and belief in the system to take your foot off the pedal during that time and actually taper, focus on the weight cut, and then allow yourself to peak come fight night.
Absolutely. And you're talking about there about adjusting the training schedule based on these guys' perceived exertion. Are you using just RPE, or what other metrics are you guys using? I know you and Felix and Corny had a big section there about athlete monitoring and decision making. What other metrics are you guys using to dictate these guys' training schedules and load management?
Yeah, so we use the SRSS scale as well for the subjective wellness. That's on we have daily morning meetings. With the whole team, and Felix will report back to us any flags that may be coming from that. And that's not to say as soon as a flag comes, we immediately have a intervention. It's often a conversation starter to see if there are other factors that are playing into the particular flags that might be on the stress or the recovery side. We're also using introduced Oura Rings recently as well, so we have some sleep data as well, and seeing how that's affecting their training, where the nutrition will be reporting where their weight's at, and we prescribe a lot of their diets as well. So if you're putting all these data points together, and someone's cutting a lot of weight, they've got a few flags on their recovery, and their SRP is significantly higher than what the other rating is for the session. There's a few points there to start a conversation and speak with the athlete about if their potential needs to be an adjustment of training load. And it's never just like one thing that will make us change that decision. Is that's the whole point of that interdisciplinary team of knowing what the athlete is going through from all departments. Obviously I forgot PT there, so the sports medicine side, is there any injuries that's ongoing, and so that's kind of the how we try to bring everything together to create an informed decision about how we may have any particular intervention to their training load.
Yeah, it's awesome. Hey, one thing you're talking about there, Dean, we'll come back to that one, is the fight camp and the tapering, because I think that's something that we need to touch on, because as you said, so many guys just go, and you see them right up until fight week and they're still going. So I want to touch on that. But one thing that I found super interesting about this was part two, when you talk about the off camp and you guys break it up into general prep and then you go into specific preparation as well. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so I think it'd be great at some point if you get Gavin Pratt and Felix on to talk. Felix obviously is our head of sports science here in Shanghai, and then Gavin is our head of strength and conditioning. And so they are on the training load side. You know, Felix would be the best person to speak to. We're going into the finer details of that, and then on the strength and conditioning side as well, with Gav's approach to different phases and what attributes want to be working, both in a sense of ESD, but also on the you know, force velocity curve, what might be focused on, because there's like more of a deficiency focus in off camp, and we do profiling to Gav has a really good system based around creating a phenomenology of the athlete, and whether they're, you know, strong and slow, well balanced, or fast and weak, and how they how you program for those different attributes. To basically, you want everyone well balanced, and where they are on that spectrum to develop those different attributes, and that would be more of an off camp deficiency focus, whereas in fight camp is more of a making sure that there is. The non-technical training is negatively impacting technical training, because you are in fight camp, you don't want too much soreness from the training that they do. So there's an adaptation in that regard of what the focus might be, and more about speed and speed power. But on the coaching side of things, and the distinction between off-camp, general prep and specific prep, there are, again, like I said, as a general off-camp philosophy, is a weakness focus. So on that, once you create that pick the technical categories where their strengths and weaknesses are, obviously you can't work on everything that is a potential weakness, but you picking on maybe one or two things and program accordingly. So we have a core timetable at the academy that is like what I would consider the fundamentals of mixed martial arts, that regardless of style, everyone has to be proficient at, whether you're a striker, grappler, or whatever you favor. And then we have some individual what we call swing sessions that are more focused on the individual that need to develop those weaknesses. And so that's how we we bucket people into things that people need to work on, because you always get there's commonalities in certain things that people need to work on, and maybe takedown defense or whatever it might be. So in off camp, general prep off camp, again, with a weakness focus, there's more of an individualized focus on the individual technical categories. And then as you go into specific preparation, there's more of a integrated approach of bringing everything together. Because when you're, it's effectively thinking of like, think about like general prep, about stripping everything back. And really going in in terms of like coaching cues, you're more using focusing on the actual technique, like the external cues, you could think of it that way, right? Like, you know, where they might need to put their hand, where they might need to put their shoulder on a particular takedown, going into that level of detail and less tactical influence, and more focusing on the specific techniques. And then the distinction between off-camp general prep and specific prep is where there's more tactical emphasis and more a global view of the integrated MMA approach. So you may more thinking about how not just the specifics of the technique that you might be using it, but like where, how to apply that technique, and where in the octagon, for example, you might, and there's integrating technical tactical, and then also the being more integrated. So it wouldn't be just be about how the, let's use a single leg for example, it wouldn't just be about how the single leg is done, is like, where in the octagon are you doing it, how are you setting up, and what shots are you using, or traps are you laying to do that single leg. Do you know what I mean? So it's in off camp, it's more like a magnifying glass on particular technique, and then on specific prep although it's more integrated, you're thinking about MMA as a whole, because it's more specific, if that makes sense. And although that that in that general prep, there's a more looking at the individual martial arts, it's still under the guise of the technical categories that I talked about, that are, I don't necessarily like doing, certain wrestling moves, for example, that you just wouldn't do in MMA. I think like we're beyond that now. It's like, you should be only doing the wrestling things that you would do in MMA. There's no time for, you know, like neckties and stuff that you just wouldn't find yourself being in that position. It's just like, what I feel like the sport is beyond that, and you should be only doing fit-ins and you know, punches into takedowns that you would be doing if in a real, you know, in an actual MMA fight, because why would you learn skills that aren't useful? I think it's all about context. So that's kind of a coaching sort of overview of the distinction between off-camp general prep and specific prep. But there are also some considerations about, like, you know, how much communication there is at that point. When you start off in general prep, there may be lots of communication, lots of stop-start, you know, lots of feedback to the athlete. And as you go into more specific prep, it's more like creating the, you know, I talk about in the skill acquisition about the constraints-led approach, and how it's more about creating drills and scenarios that they only have the certain options of doing those techniques. So you're creating an environment for them to use the techniques you're spoon feeding them in general prep effectively, and letting them find it out for themselves in specific prep. That's maybe a little bit extreme to a version of it, but just as a general coaching philosophy, that's kind of how I see it. Because as the level of competency increases, they should be able to find out what works for their body. Because you know, what works for me compared to someone who's 6'5" and long is different, right? So you've got to create the drills that allow them to find those skills for themselves.
For this next one, I know the answer already, and it's going to be it all depends, but I'm going to try and squeeze a bit more out of you. But ideally, how much time would you want each athlete? Say you've got the ideal athlete and they're going to do the most ideal amount of fight camps and fights per year, as per your guys' recommendations. How much time are they going to be spending in, say, the general preparation phase and then the specific prep phase?
Ideal, like you said, it depends, right? But I like two cycles of both of those, and then a fight camp, I think is like really good. But that's not always possible. So it would go like general prep, specific prep, general prep, specific prep, fight camp. And in the periodization section, I talk about how a 6-week fight camp, under those circumstances, I personally think is sufficient, because as I explain in there, like, historically, off camp can be so unstructured that you know, they're a bit heavier than they should be, they're not as fit as they should be, and they're just like doing kind of random training and no one's really controlling what's going on. That's kind of what I've seen, you know, even, you know, when I was coaching before, it's hard to pin people down in off camp when they don't have a fight book to train, like, really organized and have like a structure, because they, you know, it's just, I don't know if it's the nature of personality or how it just historically runs, right? So in those circumstances, you're starting fight camp where you're probably heavier than you need to be. You're like 20% above your weight. You're not as fit as you should be. And then, so the beginning of fight camp is really about bringing your weight down, getting fit, and then or it might be all of them, because you feel really overweight, it might be all about that. But if you have an appropriate off camp where you've been managing your weight appropriately, and you're you know, more like 15% 6 weeks out or something like that, and your heart rate recovery, you know, post minute is around 1 minute post max heart rate is like you know, around 20%, you're just peaking in that 6 weeks, and then you can really focus on the tactical things that are relevant to that opponent. So, you know, it's semantics really, what the distinction is between how long the duration of the actual fight week is, because you could call that specific prep part of fight camp if you really wanted to, but it's the periodization of how you, the different ways of coaching, the different approach of the S&C, the different ratios between S&C and non-technical training. So for in general prep, we have 4 sessions a week of S&C, specific prep 3, and fight camp only 2. So there's changes in that respect across the different phases of camp. So you could draw that line wherever you want to, but I feel that the 6 week intent, and particularly in terms of sparring, you've got to think about the load to the head and the potential concussion implications and what it takes on the body. But I feel that if you are, you know, a gun to my head, how would you, what would be ideal? It would be 2 cycles through general prep and then a fight camp. And that would be, you know, you could really be working on, you can get some stuff done in 12 weeks of general prep, of that lower intensity general prep, slightly higher specific prep, back down general specific, and then ramp up into fight camp. So you can have both a physiological response so that you're where you need to be in terms of the performance markers, but then technically and tactically developing in those times as well, so that when it comes fight time, you're a much better version than you were the last time you went out to fight.
This is a little bit of a sidetrack thing, but I think it's probably a good one to get your opinion on, because you're up there, and this is probably some of the highest advice some people who are listening will hear. And you see this all the time. Like you said, guys will just fight and then they just drop off the radar, or if they train, they kind of just do whatever. How detrimental is that if they're just having this specific fight camp training and they're not doing any of this general prep?
I don't know if I would call it detrimental, right? I think the way to view it, you're not maximizing your ability to improve. So I don't know if it's detrimental. I think that like, let's just choose an arbitrary number. You're at 80 every time you fight. If you do that, you're only ever going to get to 80, or maybe 82 next time, or maybe 83. I'm just making up a number, right? It's some sort of performance measure, right? But if you're doing it the way what we're talking about, hopefully in that time you're taking that up every single time, and you're accelerating the rate in which you improve. That's ultimately what it's all about, right? So having a plan is better than no plan. Whether it's the perfect plan or not is neither here nor there, because it can always be improved, and we're constantly trying to develop what we're doing here and be having reviews, post-fight reviews, and make, you know, what we're doing right now is not the same what we started 2 years ago, but that comes through a process of review of the process. So I think that I wouldn't say it's detrimental. I just think it's not, I just say it's probably not the fastest way to improve. If you do have that, you know, because you particularly on the fitness side of things and the weight side of things, you're just going back to square one, and you get like these bounces in weight, and you see people balloon up. And I was guilty of it when I fought. I would just take time off. I also think I make a point of this in the journal as well, that I think that when you have a tough camp, and it was a lot about getting your weight down, and it was a lot about, you know, getting fit, and you didn't do, from one perspective, you're not developing as well technically and tactically. If every session you're feeling pain because you're in a calorie deficit, and then afterwards you're having to do some ESD, or the day before you had to do extra ESD because you're not as fit as you need to be. If you're already starting from a good point, and every session you're fresh to develop technically and working on the game plan, of course you do hard work to peak, but that isn't the main emphasis. You're not doing extra, you know, calorie burning runs to as well as being in a calorie deficit from not eating enough. So that takes its toll on the mind. So to get through that fight camp psychologically, it's draining. I've been there. I know how hard that is. And you've got to draw on all wills of competitiveness to try and make it through that camp. And I think often that falling off the mat stuff after the fight is due to how hard that was, and so people need that break. They're like, oh, I just can't do it right now. I need to deal. And of course, even after every fight camp, we give the guys at least 2 weeks off, and that's a little bit planned as well, what they do within that time. But if you're not forcing to draw if you plan out appropriately the off camp and fight camp, in that period they're not drawing on their competitiveness to get through it. They're just enjoying it. They're at their best, and of course you're going to have harder days and lighter days, but you know they're feeling motivated to push it through. You're not getting guys burning out. I don't want to, you know, name names, but there are certain guys in the UFC that have talked recently about burning out, right? And that I believe that comes from that type of cycle of just really, really hard camps where you've had to do all of that stuff, and it just takes its toll over time as a professional fighter. So I feel that if you plan that in, and you're not asking them to draw from that well of competitiveness, and they're just doing it out, enjoying it, and then all that competitiveness is left for when come fight day, they're more likely to come back sooner because they've enjoyed that process. And then again, right, we're starting from 70 now rather than back down to 20. Let's take it to 90 next time. And it's like that's kind of the philosophy behind that periodization and having a structured off camp. Of course, it's person individual and athlete individual, and they may need more time, they may need less time, they may want to be straight back in there if they had an easy fight. And you make those calls as they come to you. But I think that there's definitely an upside to having that structure in the off camp for going back to that assessing. If you're not assessing, you're guessing. A structured development of improving the athlete of what needs to be improved.
Yeah, absolutely. We say to our guys that it's a fight camp, not a fat camp. And there's no point. If you want to go lose weight the whole time, and if you want to, you know, just burn yourself out, go do like an F45 challenge for 8 weeks. Don't get ready to go to an MMA fight. But that's a good segue, Dean. That's a good segue into part three of the journal that we have here, the fight camp. And the first part that you talk about is that fight camp philosophy and goal setting. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so you know, there's different departments that are kind of having different goals, right? So I think let's start from the coaching perspective. You know, like I said about that environment that you want an off camp where it's you do live work and whatnot, but the competitiveness is not the main focus of off camp. It's about trying new things. If it doesn't work out, no worries, you got taken down. Or if you tried a new defense, it didn't work. Okay, what? Why didn't a new review? And it's like it's an opportunity. There's no monitoring of win and loss and like objective measures of some of those things. That it's an environment of fun and a creativity, trying new things, right? But when you go to fight camp, now I'm not saying you're not having fun. Of course, you want to enjoy what you're doing. You do what you love, and that's why we're fighters. But you know, it's more about doing what you're going to be doing in the fight, and it is about being competitive, and it is about winning every second of every round, every live round that you do, because you know, I think that competitiveness is like any attribute that you have, whether it be, you know, cardio or whatever. And I think that if you can develop it, but you don't want to have that switch on all the time, because I think that I kind of view it as that it can go down over time. You see guys later in the stage of their career not feeling as competitive. Even in myself, I'm retired now, I'm not as a competitive, I'm still a competitive person, but I'm not like I was before. I was like annoyingly competitive, and that sort of goes. And you know, I feel that having that switch alongside the one for skill acquisition, but also for the mentality that you want for them going into the fight, keeping on a coaching perspective in live rounds and sparring, how many rounds did you win, like goal setting around, you know, right, I'm doing five rounds, I've got to win a five round fight, you know, having scoring going alongside that in the live rounds against the fence, for example, like how many takedowns did you defend, or, you know, keep monitoring those types of goals objectively, and seeing that, you know, keeping that in your mind that you're trying to win every second of every minute of that while you're in fight camp is a switch that I certainly promote them trying to turn on. And then, you know, on the weight side of things, there are goals all the way through for sticking to what where diet is and those markers, whether it be 6 weeks out, 5 weeks, you know, along the way that Reed would talk to them. We have those predefined. On the S&C type of things, we're talking about what do you think, like heart rate recoverability, like hitting certain points with that. So with you know, and then even on the discipline side of things, of like being on time to appointments, all of that side of things, like all contribute to a mentality of building confidence going into the fight. So I think that's key from the major departments that go into you know, MMA preparation, having goals that you're meeting along the way. It's just like tick boxes of like contributing to confidence, plus knowing that you've got that plan of your approach to preparation. I think that's really key, because, you know, yeah, well, confidence is key going into a fight.
This is a good segue. We said it earlier that we'll come back to it. I want to get your thoughts and opinions on it, and what you guys spoke about, the tapering and peaking. And then let's use that to talk about going into fight week, because as you said earlier, a lot of these guys just go, 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 and they'll keep going right up. Talk to us about the training, the fight camp, the proper tapering and peaking, how that's meant to lead you into fight week.
Okay. So what I'll preface it with, which is what's really important, is that there should be, like as I talked about a review, I think a review of the taper and a review of fight week and a review of the fight day warm-up, the review of the fight warm-up is key to streamlining that process for the individual, because every athlete is going to be different when it comes to those things and what makes them feel good, what makes them feel sharp, what makes them feel powerful. And to a degree, there's no particular wrong or right with some of those things. If they feel good from it, then it's good, then it's fine for them to do. But if they're going into the fight and they said, oh, you know, I was feeling, it was a slow start, I couldn't get myself going, that's to do with the preparation that went on in that week, and probably overtraining and, you know, central nervous system fatigue and a number of, it's hard to know exactly the contributing factors that play into it, but normally it's because of that. But if they're feeling great, then there's no issue. So starting with that as a starting point, before they get to the UFC, you would have hoped that you're having with your athlete those type of conversations about the taper, those type of conversations about the intensity and duration of sessions during fight week, so that by the time you get to the big leagues, you are zoned in, you are peaking. Whereas sometimes I've, you know, there maybe never been a conversation about that. Like, how did you feel in the week, or how do you want those sessions? It's just like, this is what we did before. And this is what we're doing. You know, one of the great things about starting out here at the PR Shanghai, at Shanghai, those initial conversations that we had, I had everything that I thought I used to do. I asked, why did we do that? And there were some things that I only did because that's what my coaches did. And I never thought about how is that preparing me, right? Do you know? So it was really good to have that type of insight into some of the decisions that I thought were like fact about the way you prepare. And I was like, oh, actually, no, that's just what we did. So long story short, it has to be individualized to the athlete. And you're hoping that by the time they get to the UFC, that you have streamlined that. But things to consider is that there needs to be a drop in training load. So total training load across that time. So intensity can stay up to some degree, but if you like you want to maybe potentially manipulate the work to rest ratios. So, you know, if in fight camp, you were doing 5 minute rounds or five minute rounds of pads, of hard pads, maybe the duration of those rounds are less and the rest between those rounds are increased. So they're still feeling that they're hitting hard, they're feeling powerful, but it's not the same taxing on the body in terms of the effect that it has on training load. And one of the other things I like to do on a Monday is like alactic pads. So like 10 second bursts of really hard pads, and then like on every 2 minutes, so like a minute 50 off. And that's like often viewed as like quite a strange way to do pads, because we don't, you know, normally during camp, you wouldn't necessarily do that. But the response we've had so far from our fighters, and I used to previously do it as well, is really, really positive, because you can get like decay for some of those physical attributes if they haven't been done for, 7 days, 14 days or whatever. And so having that alactic pads on the Monday can often, you get that sort of peak. Think of it in terms of like potentiation for the fight night on Saturday. And then, so if you're comparing training load from 3 weeks out, so we've got fight week, 2 weeks out, and then 3 weeks out, that third week is the hardest, highest training load week. And then we go into the second week, and then Monday, Tuesday is still the same as, or same or similar than the Monday, Tuesday before. And from that Wednesday, we're really beginning to start that taper where duration of session is reduced, intensity can be maintained, but the effect of that to the training load is obviously a reduction in training load of the duration of its you know, training intensity multiplied by duration. So, and then what happens in those individual sessions is more down to, like I said, what the individual athlete likes to work on, some game plan stuff. But it's just, you know, there shouldn't be any sparring at that point. You're not gaining anything from the sparring unless it's like, you know, touch sparring and moving around. There should be nothing higher intensity to the point that they're taking any impacts or, you know, the risk for cuts and whatnot. And it's about, yeah, one of the key ways to reduce training load is a reduction in duration, right? So if they feel like they still want to, you know, hit hard, they can do that, but the duration of the rounds is less and the rest is more. So without going into the specifics, which we kind of did in that section, we give a generic fight week of what that fight week looks like. And that would be an example of something that I would consider like doing, if you're doing one hard training session per day and another one a bit more lighter, the harder training session at the same time that you expect to fight, particularly if you're traveling, that helps with potentially any jet lag. But even if you are on the same time zone, it's still just good for preparing your body for the way that your hormone balance is and you know, peaking yourself at that right point. But outside of that, like I said, it would become any more detailed than that, you'd be going into what is specific to the individual and what they feel makes them feel good. But the key takeaway I would say would be that before they got to the UFC, they should have a pretty decent understanding of how they like the warm up, how they like fight week, and how far out the taper, whether it be 2 weeks or 1 week or somewhere in between.
Just from your own experience as an athlete and also from your position now working with these top level athletes for years and years and years, does that extend to fight day as well? Like you said, you know, you hope by the time that they get to the UFC, they've got this process down pat and whatnot. Does all of this extend to fight day so they have the same fight day routine? Say a lot of guys want to get a shakeout in the morning. Is there certain attributes that you like to see in the shakeout in the day, or other things you like done fight day?
Yeah, no, I like a fight day shakeout for sure. I think it's just, you know, often, even if you have a good weight cut, your body just sometimes can feel a little bit flat the next day, just because it's been through, you know, a process. And even a good weight cut is still challenging to the body, right? And a good rehydration and recovery protocol, it still just feel sometimes a little bit heavy in the morning. You've drunk a lot the night before, the day before, and you wake up feeling a bit heavy, your legs feel a bit heavy. And so just having that shakeout, getting your heart rate up, a short, sharp session, doesn't have to be too long. Short work, long rest, because it also, I feel like your perception of time is heightened. So I feel like things feel longer. So they're not only for, you know, making sure they're not overtrained on fight day, but for that mentality side, just like short and sharp. And they, even if they don't know how long the rounds are, like a 2-minute round, they're just like, bam, you know, sharp on the pads or whatever they're doing. And it could, it's psychologically make them feel really good and slightly longer rest, even if it's, you know, a 3-minute round and a minute and a half, 5 minutes and 1 minute off, right? And keeping it that, and then just refreshing what they need to be doing. And again, making them, making sure it's what they want to be doing. And then the same for the warm-up. Some guys like to go into the fight on a second wind. Some like to go literally just get the heart rate up and walk out there. And there's certainly no wrong or right with that, because that's 100% about how they feel and what, you know, what makes them feel good. If they go in there and they don't feel great, then maybe it's for the next fight, it's worthwhile looking at other options, trying it out in training. I mean, you can never fully recreate the emotions that are involved in with the pressure involved that are on a fight night, but still there can still things that you can try out and see, oh no, I actually felt good there, let's try that on the next one. So more specific examples than that, because like I said, it's down to the individual. But I would say that manipulating that work to rest ratio while keeping the intensity up is a good way to go about it.
Yeah, it's something that I've noticed you guys do really well at the UFCPI Shanghai, and I think it's completely doable because you have the academy model and you have those guys there. Is that post-fight review, and you spoke about it before, and you know, the return to training, give the guys a couple of weeks off and then get back into it. Can you talk to us about that? What's involved in the post-fight review, and how do you plan this return to training? What is the gold standard as you guys use it?
Yeah. Right. So basically, so if they fight on the Saturday, Monday they come back in, they were, depending on how the fight went, well actually it actually starts post fight, so we have a post fight questionnaire that I will fill in with the athletes, or if we have PT support there, they will fill in. And it's about 15 questions and related to like the outcome of the fight, how they felt, were they rocked, did they lose consciousness, those type of questions. And if they did, there's another set of questionnaires like do they know where they are, do they know what the date is, and just in case there was any concussion or anything, that there's immediate questionnaire for me to fill in. So that's the start of it, and immediately I'll report that night back to Paul or whoever's most likely Paul, who's our head of physical therapy. And so he knows on Monday what's coming into him. He's not just a fresh read. And if there is anything that needs to go to hospital, we'll make that decision there and then. Like actually, at a recent fight, one of our guys broke an orbital, and it's a Chinese event. So the medical support there wasn't quite what you would expect at a UFC event. So I was doing the assessment and I sent what I sent to him from the back of that. He called me immediately and he's like, oh, it sounds like he needs to go to hospital because the swelling was bad around the orbital. I had a feeling that it was potentially a broken orbital as well, because I've done quite a lot of cut work over my time, cutman work. And we sent him to hospital and it was a broken orbital. And, you know, that was a safeguard that we've have in place for that scenario that I just mentioned. But then for another fighter that fought that night, no issues, but still had some soreness to his leg from low kicks. I just put that in the report. But then on Monday, the first people they see is having an ortho screen. If there was any potential concussion, going through the C3 logics and the concussion screening that we go through. And we have baselines of all of our athletes And if they're asymptomatic, then there's no issues. But if they're, you know, CT logics are, there are some abnormalities there and there are some concussion symptoms, then we take them through the graduated return to play, which is extensively gone through in the journal, which that's probably a bit long to go through that in itself. That's a podcast in itself, going through how we developed that graduated return to play. But let's assume that there was no concussion. And then we have Reed and Taylor will have a nutrition review about the weight cut, seeing how that, any feedback around that, how they felt about it. We actually like to take RPEs for how they perceive the weight cut went, and using that same scale that they're used to. I mean, that process hasn't been validated in terms of research, but we like to do it just for getting some type of gauge of how they felt it went and then any potential adjustment that we may want to make moving forward. And then on the Tuesday, I will have a fight review. We'll watch the fight back with them. I'll give them any notes that we made about the fight, technical feedback, tactical feedback. And then there's a questionnaire, which is also in the journal, that we go through them about how they felt the fight camp went, how they felt the warm-up went, like we were just discussing then. And then on the actual fight, how they felt in the fight, did they feel, were there any surprises, et cetera, et cetera. There's a few questions. I can't think of all of them off the top of my head. Then that's it for their review. And then then normally they leave on the Wednesday after that, and they're not asked to do any training in that time. They can do some steady state stuff. They want to just do some work from them. But then we're giving them like a 10-day break from that point. If they want to come back in earlier than that, we try not to let them come back any earlier than a week. So that would be the Monday after the Monday they're just. So yeah, sort of just like eight, nine days after the fight, but preferably we'll give them that 2 weeks off, and that's completely unstructured. But they do have a list of like non-technical workouts, like well, that they have online that they could access if they want to do something, and if they want to do some non-technical training. If they did want to do technical, we ask for them not to spar in that time. But they can do some technical training if they want to. But we recommend that we just, you know, give themselves a break from that, allow their bodies to rest, allow their minds to rest. And then barring any other mitigating circumstances like injury or, personal things that they need to sort out, they'll be back in the gym 2 weeks from the fight. And that's kind of that process that we go through for every athlete that goes through a fight here. And then when they return, they go back to a return to training protocol, which is over a 3 week cycle. Their sparring volume is reduced, their live rounds volume is reduced, but apart from that, they're in the same program. And then Gavin from the S&C side of things also has a return to play S&C program, which is different to general prep, specific prep, and obviously fight camp. So that's normally the plan and the process over that 3 week cycle. And then hope if it goes perfectly, they go return, because everyone's working off these 3 week cycles, because logistically across the academy that works best. And they'll do the return to play, general prep, specific prep. And then if they don't have a fight going back, then they would cycle back to general prep, specific prep, and then hopefully a fight. But look, realistically, that doesn't always happen. Sometimes it might go general prep, specific prep, they go back to general prep, and then a fight gets booked and they go into fight camp. You might give them like 1 week transition week, or depending how it lines up, we'll do like transition weeks that take them from phase to phase. It obviously doesn't always sit pretty with 3 week cycles, and we adapt accordingly. But in an ideal world, that's how it would work. But sometimes we try to never let them take a fight less than 6 weeks notice.
It's super interesting, right? And I think something you said at the start is in the last 2 years, how far you guys come, and you guys are still developing and still working, still building on this system. Last question before I let you get back to it, Dean, I know I'm taking up a lot of your time, but last question, what do you think are the major areas that we're going to see improving in mixed martial arts, say when you guys do the next volume of this journal? I know you don't want to think about that after you just did all of this, but say in the next volume of the journal, what are the major areas you think that we'll see massive improvements in or major changes in?
I'm not sure if... In represented in the journal, but from my perspective, from a coach's perspective, I see that the standard now of even amateur, right? Like elite IMAF, in IMAF, the tournament in IMAF, there are guys at all IMAF that were, in my day, would be successful pros, right? The standard of MMA has risen dramatically, and the integration of MMA techniques and people coming new to MMA. And I think the coaching techniques that are in and mindsets of people from my generation of fighters who are now becoming coaches, who when we fought, none of our generation had, we didn't have fighters. None of my coaches were MMA fighters. And the people that fought in my generation, there's a few guys like Conor Silvera, one generation above, but there's not many that had, right? So there's a whole generation of fighters that are coming through that have coaches who are my age or a little bit older who are actual MMA coaches. So that is where you're going to see that, I think, the biggest shift in the technical and tactical development. But then also, with the work that we're doing on the performance side, the integration and of periodization and the adoption of some of those philosophies that are not necessarily just coming from us, but I think people are starting to realize that you can't just train hard all the time. That, you know, the injury risk involved in that is not great. The getting the most out of the athlete isn't the best either, or optimal. So integrating those technologies like or even practices like training load management or monitoring, and seeing the modernization and the adoption of technology into MMA, I think would be the biggest shift, particularly as where some of the like athlete management systems are, you know, you can have apps for them and whatnot. So it's so easy for and cost effective to have some of them systems, whereas potentially maybe previously some of those technologies that are involved are like cost prohibitive that a coach, you know, couldn't have. And the adoption of like it's not signed yet, so I don't want to go into the details of it, but some sort of monitoring software around training and breaking down and coding training. I think that would be a key area that the sport could move into, that other sports have the stats around those types of things, which MMA just doesn't have. But, you know, it's just standard in football, standard in rugby. And I think that could be a huge change that we see once that becomes more affordable and more teams are integrating that in terms of like coding the statistics around different techniques and what happens in fights and whatnot. So I'd say that would be a pretty key one as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's crazy, hey, how far MMA has come, but how far it's yet to keep going. But Dean, I'm sure everyone listening to that, their brain will be absolutely buzzing and they'll be thinking, man, I've got 1,000,001 questions for Dean I need to ask him. If they want to get in contact with you, if they want to ask you a couple of questions, what's the best way for them to get in contact?
Well, on Twitter and Instagram, I am at Dean Amasinger, DEANAMASINGER. And that's probably the best way. I'm more on Instagram than I am Twitter. I'm not massively on either, if I'm completely honest, but always happy to answer questions. That's part of what we're trying to do. Part of what the PI is trying to do is like share knowledge. There's no secrets here. So always happy to engage with coaches and have conversations. You know, I want to expand my knowledge as well and what other people are doing and you know, compare notes and whatnot. So any questions with that respect, or even if you're not a coach, just I'm always happy to have those conversations. So very open to that.
All right, Dean. Well, what an episode, eh? What a way to kick off the discussion of the journal. And I think now I'm thinking, wow, there's so much info. How are we going to get through all this? I might have to book out the next 3 months to go through it all. But
like I said, I think that, you know, but you know, both you've had a few guys from Vegas and here, but speaking to someone like Felix and Gav, and you know, I know Reed's been on a couple of times, but that would be really really good, I think. And just going into the finer details of some of their respective departments and the philosophies around that and how that works, because I'd leave it to those guys to you know, it's their babies, and I've just sort of given you the overview, but really it's their stuff that they've developed, so it's great if they can have the opportunity to talk to you about that as well.
Yeah, I'll absolutely get Gav back on, but now that we're filming it, I've got to make sure that he doesn't have the stash on his face anymore. Don't need to cream the views too much. But anyway, Dean, we'll chat again soon, mate. Thanks so much for taking the time. I know you're super busy. Thanks for coming on, mate.
Always a pleasure, mate. Really good to speak to you.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. That's a great overview of the technical analysis aspect of the new volume of the UFC PI Journal. Dean offers so many great learning points for coaches, athletes, and practitioners, and I highly recommend listeners to download the entire copy and have a read into all of the nitty-gritty details. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.